Welcome to the Luncheon Speakers Series from the Economic Club of Indiana in downtown Indianapolis. This month's speaker is Lance Izumi, Director of Education Studies at the Pacific Research Institute in San Francisco. Izumi says it's not just low-income students who are struggling in the public school system. He says nationally, 6 in 10 community college students must complete remedial courses. He says all children should be allowed access to good quality education, regardless of their hometown or their parents' income.
Lance Izumi believes the best path to reach that goal is through school choice. His writings and research have helped shape education strategy. He's co-author of a book, Free to Learn, Lessons from Modern Charter Schools, which has been used as a guide for creating high-performing charter schools in New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. Mr. Izumi believes the way that government plans to spend the current federal stimulus dollars for public schools will produce the same old disappointing results. He says that money would be better spent on vouchers so parents could select public or private school of their choice. Mr. Izumi is now serving his second term as president of the Board of Governors of the California Community Colleges, the largest system of higher education in the nation. In 2008, the U.S. Army appointed him to its Southern California Advisory Board Executive Committee. In that role, Mr. Izumi assists the Army in community outreach and recruiting efforts. Today, we'll discuss his topic. It's not just the poor kids, why we need to worry about the performance of middle-class children. I, like each of you, are looking forward to his remarks. Please give a warm welcome to Mr. Lance Izumi.
Well, thank you very much, Steve, for that very generous introduction. I really appreciate it. It's a great honor to be here today, to have been invited to speak before all of you. The truly impressive list of people who have appeared here in front of the Economic Club of Indianapolis is a testimony to the impact that the Economic Club has not only in your city, but throughout Indiana and the nation. Sally Pipes, the president of Pacific Research Institute, was a speaker here, and so was our head of our environmental section, Steve Hayward. So I'm glad to be following in that honorable list of people. Let me thank the staff here at the Economic Club for arranging my visit. I really appreciate that. And I especially want to thank Tim Wright with the Educational Choice Charitable Trust for hosting and sponsoring my visit here to Indianapolis. The trust does fantastic work providing scholarships to low-income students so that they can attend non-public schools of their choice. Yesterday, Tim took me over to the Oaks Academy, which is in an area that he told me was once called Dodge City, and for obvious reasons from what I understand. I was so impressed, however, by the students who I met over there and the teachers and the administrators that at the Oaks Academy that it certainly fulfilled the goal of the Charitable Trust to ensure that there was good education for all children here in Marion County. So I want to congratulate them on all their great work. I also want to mention, too, that give a great kudos to Tim Wright personally because he took me all over Indianapolis while battling a terrible cold and that inclement weather. So he went over and above the call of duty. So I was the question was not whether I would get here today, it was whether Tim Wright would get here today. I want to thank everybody here at the head table, all the sponsors of this great organization and these events for providing this type of opportunity for people like me to come and address you. I certainly wish we had this same type of organization back in Sacramento where I'm from. And so I'll probably be talking to Steve Walker here about how we can do something like that. I want to especially thank my friend here on my right, Robert Enloe at the Friedman Foundation. I've known Robert for many years, and we've been great allies and cohorts in the fight for school choice. Although I sometimes wonder about that friendship, because last night he kept egging me on to try that shrimp cocktail at St. Elmo's. And I'll tell you, he wouldn't let up on me, So I take advantage of the newbie from California, right? As I mentioned, in addition to my day job as the senior fellow and director over at the Pacific Research Institute, I serve as president of the Board of Governors of the California Community Colleges. We have 110 campuses throughout California with 2.7 million students, which makes us the largest system of higher education in the country and one of the highest, largest in the world. Yesterday, I had the opportunity to visit Ivy Tech Community College here in Indianapolis at the kind invitation of Ivy Tech President Tom Snyder. I met with his great staff, and we had a very productive conversation, sharing our thoughts on the challenges facing our institutions. And I was very impressed with the work going on at Ivy Tech, and I'm glad that he's going to be a speaker here next year. And I told President Snyder that we in California have a lot to learn from Ivy Tech's many successes and innovations, especially in workforce development. And I want to also let him know that I am at this very moment wearing my Ivy Tech pin that he gave me. So I'll be a walking billboard for you back in California. So let me tell you about what I want to talk about today. We all know that low-income students in this country are struggling. Only 15% of low-income fourth graders and 17% of low-income eighth graders score at or above the proficient mark on the national reading, the last national reading exam. We assume, however, that middle-class students and more affluent students are doing just fine. But the question is, are they really? Today I'd like to talk to you about middle-class students and their families, the quality of the education they are receiving, the education options that they are and are not available to them. Let me first start by looking at things from the perspective of higher education. Now, the California community colleges have an open admissions policy, which means that anyone, regardless of their academic background, can enter our colleges. We get students who are aiming to transfer into a four-year institution, who want job preparation through our career technical education programs, and who are simply pursuing an interest of theirs or boning up on a particular skill. Many people don't know this, but Arnold Schwarzenegger learned to speak English by going to a community college. He started taking English classes at a community college in Santa Monica near Los Angeles back in the early 1970s. Now, at a commencement speech a couple years ago, Governor Schwarzenegger said that he had memories of pulling up in front of the community college in my Volkswagen to register for English classes. Now, my question is, how did Arnold Schwarzenegger ever fit in a Volkswagen? So, yet for our students at our community colleges, too many of them have one sad thing in common. They have an unacceptable proportion of them need remedial instruction in English, writing, or mathematics. In fact, system-wide, and I was discussing this with President Snyder yesterday, more than 7 out of 10 students at our colleges need remedial basic skills education. Nationwide, 6 out of 10 community college students complete at least one remedial course. In fact, at some of our colleges in California, you have examples such as at one Southern California campus, 98% of those students who are assessed end up needing remedial education in either English, writing, or mathematics. Virtually every single entering student. Now, students who require this basic skills knowledge have a very low probability of achieving success in the math and English courses that they need to transfer into a four-year institution. Only a little over 5% of the students who need a basic skills math course and only 14% of students who need a basic skills English course succeed at a transfer level course in those subjects. Now, these statistics are very disturbing, and the impact on students in our society are devastating. However, it's important to realize that it's not just the open admissions community colleges that are faced with this sea of underprepared students. The California State University system, which I'm familiar with, which is supposed to admit the top one-third of high school graduates in our state, is also facing a similar problem. Our state universities, which include places like San Diego State, Fresno State, Cal State, Los Angeles, have about 400,000 students in our system. Yet in 2006, upwards of 60% of our incoming freshmen needed remedial instruction in English, math, or both. And unfortunately, what happens is that many of these students who need remedial education end up not graduating. At our state universities, only 40% of entering 2,000 freshmen who took a remedial course graduated in 5 years. And this, again, is not a California problem. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, three-quarters of U.S. college students taking a remedial course in English and more than 60% who take a remedial course in math fail to earn either a two-year associate's degree or a four-year bachelor's degree. And while not specifically related to the remedial issue, I think it's worth noting that only about 1 out of 2 students in Indiana's colleges and universities graduate within a six-year time period. All this is bad news for the business community. A lot of you here, I know, are business people, because what we're talking about is your future workforce. Now, my colleague here at Pacific Research Institute, who's sitting here up at the head table with me, Vicki Murray, did a study on remedial instruction, the remedial instruction problem in California, and estimated that the annual direct and indirect costs of this remedial education came to about $14 billion for just one cohort of college students. So, you know, what is this, you know, so the point here is, what does bringing up all these indicators of poor student preparation for higher education mean? And how does it relate back to the topic I want to talk to you about? Well, it's to show that our education problem is not just limited to the places that we all associate with poor education performance, such as low-income areas. All right? Many, if not most, of the students who need this remedial instruction come from middle-class backgrounds, more affluent backgrounds, from seemingly nice middle-class neighborhoods and seemingly good middle-class schools. Yet those schools have not prepared these students to students adequately in the core subjects for higher education. My colleague, Vicki Murray, and I wrote a book called Not As Good As You Think, which Steve Walker was kind enough to mention in his introduction. But in this book, we looked at the various indicators of student performance at middle-class and more affluent schools in California. And what we found was really eye-opening. Let's look, first of all, and I don't want to bore you too much with a bunch of California stuff, but it does have relation to other states and across the country. There's a test that we have in California called the Early Assessment Program, or EAP, which was instituted by the California State University System. This is a set of exam questions attached to our regular 11th grade tests and are designed to alert students as to whether or not they're college-ready in English or mathematics. Students can elect to take this exam or not, but most elect to do so. If one examines the EAP results at public high schools in middle-class and affluent areas in California, it turns out that many of the students in these supposedly good schools are not prepared in these core subjects. Now, first of all, before I go on, let me ask you, have any of you visited Los Angeles before? Oh, good. A lot of you have. Improve our economy, too. And have any of you who have visited L.A. actually made that mistake of buying one of those touristy map of the stars that Jay Leno makes fun of? Don't see too many hands. Oh, my gosh. Steve Walker actually said that he bought one of those. Good heavens. Well, I'm glad that most of you have not, because you probably have about as much chance of seeing a star at a delicatessen in Malibu as you would actually going to their homes. I grew up in L.A., so I know what a little bit about that. But to make it a little bit more interesting for you, I'm going to actually give you a little Hollywood and celebrity tour of California schools. Let's take a school called Torrance High School. The city of Torrance is an affluent beach community near Los Angeles. My brother actually lives there. Now, most of you have never heard of Torrance or Torrance High School, but I'm sure you've actually seen it on television, because the facade of Torrance High was actually the setting for Beverly Hills 90210 and also Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So, I mean, unfortunately, a lot of the students at Torrance High may seem to have had the academic blood sucked out of them, because that's rough, huh, Robert? Yeah. Because less than one in four students taking the EAP exam, one in four students, scored at the college-ready level in English. Now, what about my own backyard? I live in Sacramento now. Grew up in L.A. and live in Sacramento, the state capital. And one of our region's pricey suburb is a place called Granite Bay. John Travolta, Eddie Murphy, supermodel Tyra Banks, they all lived in Granite Bay. In Granite Bay High School, virtually all white and Asian, very few English language learners, and virtually no one on the federal free and reduced lunch program. And yet, at that school, just more than a quarter of the students taking the EAP exam were college-ready in English. In fact, of the 157 regular public high schools in California with predominantly low-income student populations, and where at least 90% of the kids took that examination, only four out of the 157 in 2006 scored, did more than half of the students score at the college-ready level in English. So these shockingly poor results on that exam, however, are only part of the story in our state. We look at our regular state English examination. Take Hillsdale High School in the city of San Mateo near San Francisco. Now, I know that this is Peyton Manning country over here, but San Mateo is probably best known as the place where New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady grew up. Yes, feel free to boo. I really dislike the Patriots, too. So, Now I actually say that in Boston if I ever get invited there. So, in 2006, the median home price in Hillsdale High School's zip code was $867,000. Now, even with the plunge in California real estate prices, I mean, this is a very pricey suburb. Yet at that high school, only 4 out of 10 of the 11th graders scored at the proficient level on the state English examination. Now, Tom Brady's not very popular here in Indianapolis. What about another Tom? How about Tom Hanks? Everybody loves Tom Hanks, right? Tom Hanks was born in the city of Concord, which is near San Francisco as well. And the median home price over there is about just over $500,000. Now, the local high school there is Clayton Valley High School. And yet, at Clayton Valley High, same like at Hillsdale High School, only 4 out of 10 of the kids there are proficient in English in the 11th grade. Now, you never know that there is such poor performance going on at that school by looking at Clayton Valley, because I've seen that, and you look at the neighborhoods. But just like Forrest Gump said, life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. And how about Laguna Beach High School in Laguna Beach, where in Orange County, where Disneyland is? Any fans of the Beach Boys here? The Beach Boys actually named Laguna Beach in their song Surfing Safari, and you'll recall that song. Well, the kids must still be surfing because only 3 out of 10 of the kids are proficient on the English examination. And interesting enough, one of the things that Steve Walker and I and Vicki Murray were talking about was a conversation that we had with the principal at Laguna Beach High, who said, you shouldn't really look at those test results. You know, what you should really look at is look at how many kids are actually graduating from our high school, because you have to take a high school exit exam. Well, it turns out the high school exit exam only requires that you score 55% correct on the math section of the examination. So I don't think we're going to be taking his advice. So let me emphasize here that what we found in California is no anomaly. This is not another one of those, gosh, California sure is a messed up place type of stories, although in many ways we are pretty messed up. If you look at the results for non-low-income students on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP, which a lot of you may have heard of, which is administered in most states, and which is often referred to as the nation's report card, you find similar disturbing numbers. In 2007, nationally, only 44% of non-low-income fourth graders scored at or above the proficient level on the national reading examination. Indiana's performance mirrored the national figures, with only 43% of the state's non-low-income fourth graders scoring at or above the proficient mark. On the eighth grade reading test, nationwide, only 39% of non-low-income eighth graders scored at or above the proficient level. And again, Indiana's performance exactly mirrored the national numbers, with 39% of non-low-income eighth graders performing at or above the proficient mark. The point of all of this is that middle-class people who buy homes in seemingly nice middle-class neighborhoods also think they are purchasing high-performing public schools as well, and that turns out not always to be the case. Harvard Law professor Elizabeth Warren and her co-author Amelia Tyagi, in their influential book, The Two Income Trap, Why the Middle Class is Going Broke, wrote, talk with an average middle-class parent in any major metropolitan area, and she'll describe the time, money, and effort she devoted to finding a slot in a decent school. For most middle-class parents, ensuring that their children get a decent education means buying a home in a small subset of well-reputed school districts. Yet, as I've pointed out, many of these schools do not live up to the reputations of these neighborhoods. I should mention, however, that it's not always easy for parents to actually tell whether how good or how bad the performance of their schools are. Vicki and I found when we were doing our book that a number of these underperforming middle-class schools were actually awarded something called the California Distinguished School Award. And whatever went into the criteria for making up that award, student performance was actually not very high. So even if parents get around this academic smokescreen and find out that their public schools are deficient, the heavy financial burden that many middle-class parents carry with them act to limit their options. Take, for example, a good friend of mine who lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. I've already told you that San Francisco is a very pricey area, and it's very difficult to survive there. My friend bought a fixer in a very nice neighborhood in San Francisco, had been sending their kids to a Catholic school in nearby, but because they bought this fixer, their mortgage payments were so high they had to take the kids out of the private school and then send them to the local public school because of the high mortgage payments. And that's not a uncommon thing that many parents have to face in this country. And even when middle-class parents do send their kids to a private independent school, it's often at a great sacrifice. When we were doing the film documentary based upon our book, Not As Good As You Think, I met a middle-class family in Nashville, Tennessee. The son is a really bright high school student, and he's got an incredible talent for composing and playing music. He, in fact, composes his own classical pieces, which I heard him perform, and they are truly beautiful and sublime. But that family decided that the local public school was not meeting the needs of their child, and therefore they made the big decision to spend their entire college fund for their child on the private high school tuition to send that kid to a good private school nearby. Now, that was a decision they made, but what that means is unless this boy gets a good scholarship to Juilliard or one of the other top universities that he wants to go for, they are probably not going to be able to afford to send him to that school, which his talent merits. So the bottom line, according to Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Tyagi, is that any policy that loosens the ironclad relationship between location, 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 and school, school, school would eliminate the need for parents to pay an inflated price for a home just because it happens to lie within the boundaries of a desirable school district. What policy do they recommend? Well, they say a well-designed voucher program would fit the bill neatly. A universally available voucher would, in their words, relieve parents from the terrible choice of leaving their kids in lousy schools or bankrupting themselves to escape those schools. Unfortunately, there are important people in this country who do not see this, and despite their own private school experiences, and not don't necessarily want to pick on them, but you know they are the most prominent people now in the country. Take President Obama and Education Secretary Arne Duncan. President Obama went to Punahou, Hawaii's top-notch private school. The new president has noted that, in his words, Punahou gave me a great foundation so that when I got older and wiser, I knew that it was to work hard and strive for excellence. I think it instills that in a lot of kids. Certainly, there was an emphasis on values and ethics and being a good citizen as well as being a good student. I didn't always observe these admonitions, but that emphasis has an impact on you. It gives you a sense of what you should be striving for. And even if you're rebelling from it, as I was during my teenage years, it still sunk in and had a long-term impact on the trajectory of my life, which is terrific, you know. My father, however, was born in Hawaii, and he was raised there, born on the Big Island in a town called Hilo, then went to high school in Honolulu. He went to a high school called Farrington High School. And if you talk to anybody who lives in Hawaii and you say that so-and-so went to Farrington High, you'll get this uniform reaction. Your brows will furrow, they'll grimace, and they'll say, wow, tough school. And it turns out that there was no way my father and his family could ever have, in their wildest imaginations, thought of going to a place like Punahou. Last July, Mr. Obama told the American Federation of Teachers that he opposes using public money for private school vouchers. He reiterated this opposition throughout the campaign. As for Arne Duncan, he said that his childhood education at the private University of Chicago Laboratory School, the same school that President Obama's kids went to while they were in Illinois before going to Washington, was his formative experience and that he was so lucky to have gone there. Attending a great school, however, shouldn't depend on luck, such as the luck of being born into a family that can afford a private education. We know that poor children and their parents can't afford the Punahous and Chicago lab schools of this world. But neither can many middle-class parents, especially nowadays. For our film documentary, we interviewed a fellow named Steve Barr, the founder of the Green Dot Charter School Network, which has charter schools all across the country. And he told us that the middle class in neighborhoods where I live cannot afford their mortgages. They haven't been able to for a long time, let alone private school tuition. To come up with a few hundred grand for K-12 education before college is back-breaking. Because of the challenges facing low-income and middle-class families, I believe that Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Tyagi are correct that a university-available voucher or similar school choice tool is the preferable answer. That's why last fall, along with my film crew, I traveled to Sweden to get a first-hand look at that country's universal school choice voucher program. A few weeks ago, the New York Times posted the video that I wrote and narrated, detailing the thinking behind the program, its successes, and the wide support it enjoys among Swedes of all political stripes. The footage included in our Times video will be included in a segment in our upcoming larger film documentary, and I've arranged with the Economic Club to show you that video in just a few minutes. But let me give you a few words of background, however. Before it enacted its universal voucher system, there was virtually no private education system in Sweden. Less than 1% of the schools in Sweden were private, and there were only two private schools in the entire city of Stockholm. These few private schools charged a very high tuition and were out of reach of most Swedish parents, including those from the middle class. The voucher system was enacted in the early 1990s under a center-right government, and under this model, every child has the money attached to their back, basically, and it follows the child to whichever school, public or private, independent, that they go to. The private schools cannot select students based upon academic background or other characteristics. They've got to take first come, first serve, basically, and the per pupil funding between the public and the private schools in terms of attached to the child is the same. And that amount varies depending on the exchange rate, but, you know, probably between $8,000 and $10,000. And what's interesting is that because it's a universal system, it enjoys widespread support in Sweden, so that even when the socialists actually came back into power in Sweden in the middle 1990s, the number of private schools actually increased exponentially under the socialists because of the popularity it enjoys throughout the country. And part of the reason for the expansion of that entire private education system has been the fact that Sweden, for a country that we all think as mainly a socialist country, actually allows for-profit companies to establish schools. One Swedish researcher has said that since larger for-profit companies running several schools are allowed, the expansion of the independent schools has been more rapid than it otherwise would have been. In fact, one of the schools that we profile in this New York Times video that you're going to see is called the Internationella Engelska Skolan, or International English Schools. And so you'll get a flavor of what they offer. And I think with that, that now is the cue that I'm going to give to the audiovisual folks at the terrific, everything, trains running on time.
In his announcement of Chicago School Superintendent Arne Duncan as his new Secretary of Education, Barack Obama said that Washington is stuck in the same tired debates that have left schools and parents to fend for themselves. He identified one of the supposedly tired debates as vouchers against the status quo. The new president, however, should take a look at Sweden, where parties of the left, center, and right all support the country's universal voucher program, which has effectively defeated the status quo.
It's very simple. It says that the public is paying, but we open up the possibility for others than the local community to run schools.
To simplify it, we implemented competition in education.
In the U.S., reformers of different political stripes have called for education funding, such as federal dollars for disadvantaged students, to follow the child to whichever public school the child attends, rather than simply sending money directly to states or school districts. Why not let that money follow a child to a private school? Sweden is doing just that.
Anybody can use their voucher to choose any school.
Because of financial limitations, most American parents send their children to their local public school, regardless of whether or not that school meets their children's needs.
Education is so important that you cannot actually leave it to just one producer. Because we know from all monopolies that monopoly systems do not fulfill all wishes.
With funding attached to their children, Swedish parents can choose between public schools and a range of private schools that span the spectrum of educational philosophies. For instance, the private independent international English school not only emphasizes the teaching of English, it also stresses high expectations, a tough love style of instruction, and constant assessment of student knowledge and skills.
The students performed very well here. We are the highest achieving school in this region of Sweden.
The school has a diverse student body, which isn't surprising since Sweden has roughly the same proportion of immigrants as the United States. In contrast to the international English school's discipline atmosphere, the Via Amelia school in Stockholm has a more relaxed approach.
Children must be able to take the time they need to figure it out on their own. It's not a matter of how strict you are or if you are trying to force knowledge into them. Knowledge has to come from within the child.
Because the new private schools have been able to meet the needs of children and parents, there is widespread support for the voucher program.
As a mentor to 16 individual students, I know that their parents are very grateful to have the opportunity to send their kids here and to receive the quality of education that they're getting. And would it be the same if they had to pay for it? Probably not.
I have friends that live in New York, and they pay so much money to go to school. Like, why do you, or go to preschool? Why don't you just go to a school? I think it's crazy. I think it's really crazy.
Back in the United States, Barack Obama wants to focus on reforming the public school system. But lots of well-intentioned people have been trying to do that for a long time. And too many public schools continue to produce students not proficient in reading or math. With no escape ticket, such as a voucher, these students remain trapped in failing schools. And that's a waste of lives.
Kids should never, ever have to stay in a school if the school is lousy. The right of the kid is to get a good education. If the public sector cannot offer it, he or she should have a right to go somewhere else.
New York City spends more than $13,000 per student. If some or all of that money followed the student to a public or private school chosen by parents, that would, as President Obama might say, give hope a chance for all of America's children.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that. Governor Per Unkel, who we interviewed there, I got to say is probably on my short, very, very short list of probably the most impressive politicians, statesmen that I've ever met in my entire life. And I've, you know, been around, as Steve has said, you know, since the Reagan administration. And, you know, I've met some very impressive people, you know, throughout my career. But Per Unkel was unbelievable. And I, after interviewing him for just a half an hour over there, it made me wish that we had a Per Unkel here in the United States, and certainly in California. Now, I wanted to say various things about the, you know, the Swedish system. But I think that what I might do is to, leave time for questions, because I know that you're on a pretty tight schedule here. And if you have questions about the Swedish system, about, our studies, or about issues in choice, or community colleges, whatever, I'd be happy to answer them, because I know that we want to leave at least 15, 20 minutes for Q&A. But let me just say that I think that, you know, the nation, our nation's educational challenges cannot, in conclusion, be neatly limited to just those areas that we think are having problems. It's not just low-income areas. It's, you know, in much more widespread than we believe. And I think the statistics show that. I think if you, you know, talk to more and more parents, you know, they're voicing that as well. So that in order for us to meet this challenge, what we're going to have to do is, first of all, recognize that it's a problem, and that we're going to have to, therefore, address the problems in these areas that we thought were taking care of themselves. Next, we're going to have to be informed about all the possible array of solutions, and not just the ones that are wrapped up for us in neat little boxes crafted in Washington or in our state capitals. We're going to have to look at what's worked in other places, even in places outside of our country, and see and look to see if those sorts of things are transferable. I asked Governor Unkel, you know, what he thought the Swedish system had to offer or to teach people in the United States. And he said that, I'm sure that other countries can learn a lot from our experiences. They just have to adjust for their different cultures, different traditions, different histories. But the idea of a universal choice program is valid more or less all over the world. And I think he's right. As he said at the end of our video, the right of the kid is to get a good education. If the public sector cannot offer it, he or she should have the right to go somewhere else. So with that, I want to thank you all very much. I appreciate all the hospitality that I've been shown here in Indianapolis. It reinforces my sincere feeling that Indianapolis is one of the very best cities in the world, and that I will look forward to my future trips back here, hopefully very soon. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Lance, and I think I can speak for all of us in saying we would welcome you back whenever. Got a couple questions, and I see them coming up, too. But let me ask a question that I had actually had thought of. This universal voucher system, what, can you speak to the economics of that a little bit? I mean, do we spend enough money already, or would it require more money?
Well, in Sweden, they basically spend about the same, because the amount of funding per pupil is the same whether the child goes to a public or a private school. It was actually, when Sweden first implemented this voucher program in the early 1990s, the amount of money attached to the child if he went to a private school was actually 85% of what the funding for the local municipal school would be. But now, after several revisions, it's now the same. So they're certainly not spending any more money on that. I think that, you know, one of the things that, Vicky Murray and I and others, you know, I know Robert Enlow, other people who have researched this issue have seen, is that the question is not so much how much money is being spent, it's how you're spending it. And whether you're getting bang for the buck doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, just how high a level you're spending. If that were the case, then, you know, the amount of money they're spending in Washington, D.C., which, depending on how you count it, is either anywhere from $13,000 to $24,000 per child, would cause it to be the highest performing place in the country, and obviously it's one of the worst. So,
actually, a couple people are on the same train of thought here, but if we were to implement a system like that, what would be the impact on the public schools? Particularly, how would they go about budgeting, or what would be the market dynamics?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that would happen, and this is something that Governor Unkel told us, because we asked him the same question, is that, what was the impact on the public schools when the Swedish voucher program was implemented? And he said that it was only after the universal voucher was implemented that you had headmasters who all of a sudden said, well, now they began to take notice, and they looked at their competitors and said, if those people can do it, then so can we. And it's lifted up the performance of the public schools. In fact, there have been a number of studies done on the Swedish voucher system, and one of the major findings that they has been that not only have the children who have gone to the private schools done better, but the test scores and the grades of students who still choose to go to the public system have also risen up significantly. And what's interesting, too, is that this has been especially the case for immigrant students in courses such as mathematics. After the voucher, public school grades and test scores for immigrants have gone much higher.
Yeah, there's a number of questions on this sort of this general topic, so I'm just going to try to hit them as much as we can. What was the experience in Sweden, or what do you think would be the experience? Would it continue to attract new entrants into the education market? Did they see more people coming in to provide the service?
Yes, I think that's what you're seeing over there. I mean, of course, when the initiative was first enacted in the early 1990s, you know, to go from a very statist or government-centered system to one that allowed a lot more open competition was something that people had to get used to. But now, depending on the sector, the region of Sweden, you'll find 10, 20, 30% of the students now in the private independent schools, and that's a lot of schools considering the fact that it's only been around for a relatively short period of time. And again, part of the reason is because Sweden had decided that they would allow for for-profit schools to enter the market as well. The international English schools that you saw have actually 14 schools across Sweden, and they're a for-profit company.
I have to assume this is correct, but apparently one of our attendees says that the city of Milwaukee has instituted a voucher system. Are you familiar with that? Do you know any about their results?
Oh, yes. The Milwaukee voucher program is the oldest, one of the oldest, anyway, programs that we have here in the United States. It's limited to low-income students. I think it's about 15,000, is it right now, Robert? About 15,000 low-income students in Milwaukee. And, there have been a lot of studies done on that. The best ones are done by Paul Peterson over at Harvard University, and they have shown that the students who are going through the system, the voucher system there, are doing better than had they remained in the previous Milwaukee public school system. But also, what's important is that those in from the Milwaukee public school system have said that their focus and their efforts to improve their schools have been better since the implementation of the program. Howard Fuller, who is the former superintendent of the Milwaukee public school system, you know, has been an avid supporter of the voucher system because he's seen not only the opportunity it gives to the students who receive it, but also, too, he's seen how it affects the system in terms of improvement.
Actually, another person sort of asked what would happen in big inner-city school systems if you had the voucher system. It seems like Milwaukee would be a good benchmark there. Here's another one. Finland has no private schools, and there is no cost to families from preschool through college. They are considered to have one of the best, if not the best, education systems in the world. Have you studied their system, and why are they succeeding without private schools?
Well, I can't, to speak to Finland. I mean, I wish I could give you, a dissertation on that, but maybe that would be for the next film documentary. But, what I'm saying is that, if you looked at the problems that Sweden had in prior to the voucher system being implemented there, it's amazing how many of the problems when we talk to parents and students were very similar to the ones that we have here in the United States. I mean, we often think of the Scandinavian countries as being kind of nirvana in education. Everything is, very orderly, very well run, et cetera. And in talking to, for example, a group of students at the International English School, what I found was that I could have been talking to kids at any large metropolitan school district here in the United States, because when I asked them how was their experience in their former public schools, one of the students told me that, if I were still there, I'd be five times more stupid. But, that's all the candor of youth, that did not make it into our film. So, Governor Unkel told us afterwards, when I brought up that episode, he says, the point is not that, the Swedish public schools were bad. There are good and bad schools, both public and non-public. The point of it is the competition between the schools caused all these schools to become better, and that was the important point.
Here's a couple questions about what role the teachers' union played in Sweden, as that would probably be an issue in our country.
And in fact, we were very interested in that when we went over there as well, because, how was it that a country such as Sweden, which has a very strong teachers' union, just like, here in many states in the United States, how did they overcome that? And so we asked Governor Unkel, who at the time was the former Minister of Education when the program was adopted, how were they able to overcome the opposition of the teachers' union? Of course, in the Swedish parliamentary system, under that particular government, they had a majority, and if that was part of their agenda, they were able to enact it, and so that's what they did. I mean, here in the United States, it's a much different system, fortunately or unfortunately, it's simply different. But after it was enacted, the socialists who have the support of the teachers' union came back into power just a very few years after the enactment. But because it had a universal component to it, there was already so much support within Swedish society that even though the teachers' unions opposed it, the socialists did not dismantle it. And so over the years, according to Governor Unkel, he says that the teachers' union have realized that there's broad-based support for this, that, in fact, a lot of members, their members actually like it, because the private schools are free, if they'd like to have the union members. And so, it's a case of where their members are, not that members are only in the public sector. So the question is satisfying both the public and also their own members.
You mentioned quite a few statistics about kind of the famous schools or the high-income schools not meeting the proficiency. Do you have any data from private schools or private schools, particularly those that are serving perhaps a more difficult population?
Well, it's always a little bit difficult to, do those kind of like head-to-head comparisons, because not all private schools, take the same test. One of the things that you can do with a public system is that, for example, in California, just like here in Indiana, you have one standardized test. You have the ISTEP. In California, we have the CST, so you can compare schools. So it's always tricky to be able to compare the private school performance with the public schools, outside of a voucher-type system. But where vouchers have been tried, whether it's Milwaukee, Cleveland, some of these other places, the data that has come out, the bulk of it has shown that the kids are doing at least as good or even better. And for example, the Washington, D.C. voucher, which is the center of so much controversy now because Congress and the President want to kill it, despite the fact that there's huge testimonies in favor of it amongst those in Washington, D.C., from the poor parents who are receiving the voucher, U.S. Department of Education study just came out under the cover of darkness, evidently, unfortunately, last week, that actually said that the students who are going to the voucher-receiving schools are doing significantly better in reading and at least holding their own when compared to the regular public school students in mathematics. So there is certainly evidence to show that attending those schools will be a benefit for the students who receive them.
Something you said actually is reflected here in a couple of questions. There's some, I think, sentiment here that charter schools or schools that would receive vouchers are not held to the same standards as our public schools. How would you comment on that?
Well, I mean, I should mention that charter schools are public schools, unlike voucher-receiving schools, which are private schools. The charter schools are deregulated, basically, so they're they don't have as many rules and regulations that they have to follow, which often gives them, at least in California, for example, the opportunity to not be held to the local teachers' union collective bargaining agreement. We, for example, in California profile in this film, a larger documentary, a fellow named Jorge Lopez, who's the principal of Oakland Charter Academy, who first thing he did when he came into this charter school was to fire an entire teaching corps because they had been doing such a lousy job. The school was actually performing at the very bottom of all California schools. So he fired the entire crew. He was able to do that because he was not held to the union collective bargaining agreement. But I think that if you look at the difference between the charter schools and the voucher receiving schools, it's a case where, there was Robert Enloe and I had this discussion last night at St. Elmo's about, how much accountability is there, or should there be on those schools that would receive a voucher, for example, those private schools receiving a voucher, and how many requirements should you have placed upon them. Now, in Sweden, they do place requirements on these schools that receive the Swedish version of a voucher. They require them to take the national examination, and they also require them to adhere to what they consider to be their national curriculum. Now, their national curriculum there is not necessarily what we think of as a curriculum. It's just a very goals-oriented piece of paper. It doesn't tell you how to teach the kids. It doesn't tell you what books to use. It simply says that they should learn X, Y, and Z by the time they leave this particular grade. And so, but that's their accountability there because it requires them to then allow that information to be out there so that parents can look at it and then compare and contrast with other private schools and with the public schools. A discussion we had last night was, whether a market system where parents simply demanding that their kids, be tested because that's something they want to know in terms of greater transparency of academic achievement, those would be enough to get schools, for private schools who receive a voucher, to simply implement that on their own. And that's, I think that's, a question that's, open to further discussion, but, so I appreciate that question. It's one of the hot burning issues in the school choice movement right now, is how much accountability do you want to actually place on these types of choice schools.
Lance Azumi, thank you for enlightening us today. On behalf of all of us at the Economic Club of Indiana, we thank you for being our guest today.
That's Pacific Research Institute Director of Education Studies, Lance Azumi, who spoke to the Economic Club of Indiana in April. Now, Indiana Superintendent of Public Instruction, Dr. Tony Bennett. Bennett wants to better prepare students for the global economy by increasing academic standards and the expectations of school districts.
We are looking at a number of initiatives, and we have worked very hard at doing many things. One is deregulating so that students can have access to technology as opposed to textbooks. We have lifted a seat time requirement so that students can receive more opportunities to or have more opportunities to receive math or foreign language credits. Plus, we have always also advocated for that students be in school a full 180 days, as is paid for by the taxpayers through legislation, which is minimal compared to many of the students that our children compete with internationally. So we believe that lifting science and math standards, which we have done, lifting our reading standards, which we have done, and we have some great standards. We also have a great accountability tool, but we do not have, or a great assessment tool, but we do not have a good accountability system to hold our schools accountable for students meeting those standards. So we have to increase accountability. We have to increase our expectations. We should not be watering things down. And frankly speaking, we should be preparing children to compete in a new economy that is global. Charter schools are unquestionably an option. And I think the first question you have to tackle is to say, is the fact that the accident that brings a child to the zip code where they happen to reside, because it is an accident, children have no control over where they live, should that child's future be determined by the quality of school where he accidentally falls and has to live? And the fact is, as a parent, I had the opportunity to move to wherever location I needed to move so that my children got the education we wanted them to have. And I frankly believe all parents should have that same option, which goes to Mr. Izumi's comments. But charter schools are a definite option and a definite tool. And as we sit here today in the State House having this interview, there are people in the State House lobbying to cap charter schools in Indiana and cap educational opportunities for students. As we were in the State House announcing that only 50% of our schools made adequate yearly progress, we had folks in the State House lobbying for fewer school days. So we have to raise our expectations as a community, as a state, as each school community and each school and each school corporation if our students are going to achieve. But the fact is we shouldn't leave any option off the table for our students' future. Well, again, I think Mr. Izumi's comments about the opportunity of school vouchers, which allows school choice. There is legislation currently being introduced in the General Assembly regarding tuition tax, scholarship tax credit for students of need to attend private schools, and it allows that the contribution to such a trust to be used as a tax credit. So there are many options, and our job should be as citizens, as adults, as educational leaders, we should help children pursue whatever option best meets their needs.
That's Dr. Tony Bennett, Indiana's Superintendent of Public Instruction. The next speaker at the Economic Club Luncheon Series is Juan Williams, National Public Radio News Analyst. He'll talk about the latest from Washington, an insider's view. The series is a production of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thanks for joining us. I'm Sharon Alseth.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.